So I was told I was supposed to do a biographic slide. So how many of you have never heard me speak before and don't know anything about me? Okay, well, so all right, so there's a biographic slide for those who don't know. As of November 12th of this year, it will be 40 years since I first touched a computer. I was at a university in high school. I was in high school. I wanted to play with a computer. They showed us this computer. They showed us this basic thing. There was a teletype machine. Explained basic to us. He said, "Does anyone want to try? My eyes must have been big as saucers." He calls me out. There's 75 people in the room. I get this teletype machine, and I write this basic program like in my head, type it in. It's only 5 lines, but it works the first time. My first program written before an audience of 75 people, which gave me an unreasonable expectation for how good my coding skills would be over time. So that's just the way it is. So I've written books, and I do magazine articles, and I do classes, and I consult and stuff like that. Mostly, I'm an operating system geek. One of my bestest friends in the world is someone you probably know, Mark Rusinovich. And we're both like that because whenever I'm in town, Mark and I get together, we knock off a couple bottle of wine, and we talk about stuff like buffer sizes and operating systems. So it's sad. I know it's sad. So they shipped Windows 8. I'm really excited about it. It was really, really interesting that they shipped Windows 8 so quickly, right? I mean, think about it. Windows 7, that was a quick ship, but no surprise. Windows 7 was just Vista Service Pack 3, right? But Windows 8, so how many of you have sat down and played with Windows 8? Okay. How many of you have not touched Windows 8 at all? Tell me. It's okay. All right. Good. So let me get a level set on what you guys know. Basically, here's my plan. My plan is I want to talk to you about the operating system. And the Microsoft guys were very kind to let me do this because I know that they were worried I was going to beat up on Windows 8. And I'm not going to. I mean, this is, look, Mark, you can't do a presentation about how Windows 8 sucks. And I'm going to say, I do presentations about what people don't already know. And so I said, they already know Windows 8 sucks. And so I'm not going to talk about that. No, that's not true. Windows 8 does some great stuff. But what I want to do is I want to talk about the things that you haven't heard about. Everybody's heard about Windows to Go, right? Everybody's heard about file history. And if not, there are a billion web pages on those things. I want to cover the stuff that if you're going to support Windows, if you're going to support or roll out or manage Windows 8, the stuff that you may not know. I like to say if you've implemented operating system X or Y or Z, there's a bunch of cool things you paid for that you don't know you have. And that's my goal for today. Is that a good enough goal? Just want to make sure everybody in the right place. Good. And Windows 8, fascinating because it rolled out so quickly. And you know what was even more amazing? When Microsoft says, "And Windows 8.1's coming real quick." Wow. You know, when a software company rolls out a piece of software that's controversial, and then they immediately release an update, you know, it's one of two conversations. It's either, "Oh, honey, I'm sorry. I'll never do it again." Or it's, "I did not have sex with that woman." So I don't know which one this is. We'll just have to figure it out. I do like Windows 8. I was spring-loaded to not like Windows 8. Because I looked at Windows 8, and my opinion, which I think wasn't a bad one, was if you don't have a touch device, if you don't have a touch device, Windows 8 doesn't make sense. You know, the more I know about Windows 8, the more I think that that's not true. I've got Windows 8 running on all of my systems, and I'm happy that I do. Does some cool stuff for me. Anyway, so we're going to talk about these things, why you should look at Windows 8, how to run Windows 8 without a touch on your screen. I want a big hunk on this. I'm going to spend a third of our time on the new apps. You know, the apps that no one knows what their name is. Metro apps, modern apps, what else? Windows Store apps, stuff like that. Because rolling them out, how many of you do deployment? You deploy applications for your users. Okay. You got to learn some brand new stuff. So if you'll forgive me, we're going to spend about a third of the time looking at that. And I believe I could pass along some really good skills because I've spent a lot of time working with that stuff. And I don't know if he did the talk at this Tech Ed, but at Tech Ed New Orleans, Michael Nihas did a talk about rolling out store apps. Did they do that here? If you didn't go, you missed a good talk because Michael's really smart about that stuff. It's on video, though, and they did it in New Orleans as well. So you should definitely watch that. I'm going to give you the short version of it. We have a kinder, gentler check disk. Have you ever booted your system up and you're not paying attention? But out of the corner of your eye, the color is a funny screen. It's a tan, blue, gray. And it's check disk counting down, 20, 19, 18. And you're like, no, right? You know that moment? I said this is not going to be funny. Stop laughing. So you never have to worry about it again. I'm here to tell you, friends, there's good news. There's good news. Jesus has smiled upon us. And you need fear the check disk no more. So we'll talk about that. There's recovery in safe mode, and they've changed a bit. Has anybody tried to press F8 to put Windows 8 into safe mode? Yeah, that's not going to work. So, and all those web pages that say Shift F8 works, those are written by drunks, because it doesn't work, okay? You may know me, if you've been following my talks, you know that I love command line administration, and I want you all to become command line administrators. And the reason I do that is I want to make your life easier. I love the GUI, but I can't put mouse clicks in a batch file. And that's the great thing about PowerShell. I completely love PowerShell. Let's be clear, not every PowerShell commandlet is great, but of the 1,000 plus that are in Windows 8. So let me ask a question. How many of you out there are PowerShell experts? Let me see the PowerShell experts. It's okay. All right. How many of you have PowerShell on my list of stuff I really need to learn sometime soon? Good. We're going to do a little bit of PowerShell. Can we do a little bit of PowerShell? We're going to do some. All right. I want to talk to you about, now I think actually the Microsoft guys have been talking a lot about this, the UFI and the early launch anti-malware. But I want to briefly go over it if you've missed that. We'll talk about refresh and restore. Has anybody here ever built a bootable USB stick with Windows PE? Really, I want to see more hands because it's a great tool. Am I right? Basically, it's a version of Windows, goes on a USB stick. It's great for doing maintenance. It's absolutely essential for deployment. We have Dr. Johan here, the king of deployment, and he can tell you that you're going to live by bootable USB sticks. It's gotten a lot easier, and I want to show you some of that. So those of you who didn't do it, this command is going to convince you that it's so dead easy that you can do it. All right. Then there's a thing called a primary PC. You can now get a primary PC. What's with a primary PC? I want to talk to you about that, and what can you do with it? And finally, we're going to end up with another command line tool, PowerConfig. I love this thing. It's always got something new, okay? I'm going to argue to you that Windows 8 is worth trying, and I'll tell you what. I mean, first of all, I think everybody knows this, but here's my way of explaining Windows 8. Start from Windows 7. Take away, that little button over there, What's that little guy called? Everybody says the start button, but that's not the official Microsoft word for it. What's the little button down there called? Anybody know? The what? The Windows button is another answer, but that's not the actual internal one. Anybody heard? Well, I sometimes hear people say orb, that it's the orb. Have you ever heard it's the orb? But there was some internal papers that got out of Microsoft. I'm not kidding. This is true. Some internal papers got out of Microsoft. And that little round thing with the swirly on it for Vista and for Windows 7, it's called the Windows Jewel. That's its name, the Windows Jewel. So the first thing about Windows 8 is that Microsoft has lost its jewels. Okay? So, wait a minute. Well, hang on. That sounded better in my head than it did once I said that. Let's. You know what I mean. And the big thing, and we get the start button back, but I know it's the start menu that you're not getting. The start menu, and if you think about it, how many of you have been doing Windows for 20 years? Anybody? Okay, so I want to remind you about something. Okay. How many of you like the start screen? How many of you like the new start screen concept? Yeah, okay. So for those of you who are the 8 haters, let me tell you a story. You remember when Windows 95 came out? And it had that new GUI interface. And everybody's like, where's Program Manager? I want my Program Manager. I'm going to Microsoft. I'm going to burn their building down. I will kill them and all their family, burn their houses to the ground, and salt the earth where that house was. So we got that little button, and the button popped up something small. Then Windows 98 came out, got a little bigger. Windows 2000 got a little bigger. No one remembers this, but when XP came out, it was like, whoop. People were like, crap, what's that? Seriously. In 2001, I was doing, the late 2001, XP had come out, and I was doing a keynote about this, and I made a stupid joke about it where I said, at this rate, in 10 years, the start menu is going to be so big, it's going to need its own screen. I don't make predictions anymore. Oh, you think that's bad? You think that's bad? A couple Aprils ago, when they came out with Office 365 in 2011, Office 365, I said, that sounds good, but what about next year in 2008? Excuse me, in 2012, since it's a leap year. Is it going to work on February 29th? Well, you know what happened there. So there was a leap year bug. I got an email from Microsoft people saying, this is your fault. No. All right, I'm going to make one more prediction. How many of you still on XP? Come on, you can admit it. You're in among friends. Okay, sorry. Okay, all right. So what's going to happen in April of 2014? I don't know for sure, but I'm going to predict that in April 2014, Microsoft extends support of XP for another 5 years. That's what. I don't know if that's true or not. Okay, so there's the start screen. Start screen is a new thing, and why do they have the start screen? Because tablets need big menus, big fat fingers, okay? There's the new tablet-oriented applications. Microsoft had to do this, seriously. They couldn't let another Christmas go by without an answer to the iPad. iPad is an awesome tool. How many of you have an iPad out there? Come on, admit it. I have one. I love my iPad. I also have a Surface RT, and I love that too for different reasons. How many of you have a Surface? Anybody got an RT box? Surface RT? I love my RT. So I got my order in early enough so I could get it on Windows Day, October 26th. I was like so happy. And if you spent the money, you got it by 10:30 in the morning. That's how good the promise was. We'll get this to you by 10:30 in the morning on October 26th as Steve Sinofsky is showing Windows 8 to the world. I thought, that's cool. I got it at 10:45. Could have been better, but it's all right. I fired it up, started playing with it. And the form factor is a little weird because an iPad feels like an A4 sheet of paper, whereas the Surface is a little more like a legal pad, which is fine. It had some nice built-in apps and stuff like that. But you know what I really like about it? When I'm using my iPad, if something goes wrong with the network, now, if you've been here at TechEd, you have no idea what network problems mean, because we have, exactly. Look, it's a tribute to how technical, I mean, all of you have like five devices in your bag, and they're all beaten on the network. So these poor guys at IFEMA, they never get this many technical things. Anyway, but you know, when something goes wrong with my iPad, I don't have ipconfig. You know, I feel like an idiot. I want to know the magic word to give me the Unix command line in iOS. It ain't there, you know? Surface, though. I thought the Surface RT was only going to do tablet apps. But you know what it does? It had a desktop. I said, let's just see if there's a command prompt. Ha, ha, ha. There was a command prompt. I'm like, no. No, a command prompt. I thought, this is awesome. I got check disk. I got ipconfig. I can fix stuff. This is cool. Then I thought, I was feeling a little crazy. I said, what happens if I type PowerShell? This is on an ARM device. Come on. I type PowerShell. It says, yeah. I'm like, no. PowerShell. Get out. No. So then I did a command. Get command, surround it in parentheses, .count. It's a quick way of finding how many commandlets were on the RT box. 889 commandlets. I'm like, yes, tablet, 1 gram heavier than an iPad. It's got a command prompt. It's got PowerShell. It's got an 889 commandlets. Yes, I would have married the thing. But I live in Virginia. And it's under the age of 13. So it was... You've been to Virginia. It's a great place. Also, there's a part of Windows 8 that I call Windows 7.5. Forget the tablet. Forget the start screen. Forget the new applications. It gives us some cool stuff. I got to tell you, I love the security stuff. You know I'm a security guy if you listen to my stuff. I mean, Microsoft has essentially done the equivalent of eradicating smallpox. I mean, they have. If you install by the rules, you essentially eliminate, there's nothing, there's no 100%, you know? But you essentially, I know that, what's his name? John Devine said something like this at the keynote. I apologize. This is something I say when I do this talk. This is really important. This may be the single most important thing to IT pros about Windows 8. You roll out Windows 8, you do the UEFI BIOS stuff, you do the early launch anti-malware, you set up Secure Boot, you've essentially made bootkits and rootkits go away. That's freaking awesome. That's freaking awesome. So that's what I call the 7.5 stuff, the file history stuff, all those kinds of things. So that's my plan for this. Now, what if you have a device that's not a touch device? Let me tell you what I did on Windows 8 Day. On Windows 8 Day, Microsoft had a deal where for like $26, that's like €2, right? I'm not good with the conversion. It's $26 is either €2 or a kilometer, right? No? I'll figure it out one of these days. Is there a Canadian in the audience? Maybe can help me? So that's a pretty good deal. And it would do an in-place upgrade, and it wouldn't mess with any of your stuff. Now, I've been saying putting Windows 8 on a touchless device is a dumbass idea. I have this Lenovo WF510 big-ass battleship of a laptop. You can put two hard drives in it, which I totally love. And I'm watching, and Sanofsky is doing this, you know, little jumping around thing, and, you know, talking about, you know, Windows 8, how great it is. And I got the fever. I tell you, I got the fever. And I went to the webpage. There's a webpage you can go to where it says, you know, use Windows 8. And it was really colorful, well, with four colors. And they had these pictures of really happy, smiling people running Windows 8. Attractive, really happy, smiling people. Now, I know why they're so happy. You know why? Because they're attractive people. Life is good if you're attractive. You know why they're also really happy? They don't use computers. They got their little Android tablet, and that's all they really need, you know. So we don't support those people. They're not around. And the picture I really liked is a picture about how the whole family's happy with Windows 8. Whole family. Dad's on the easy chair with his laptop, you know, doing sports stuff or something. Mom's in the kitchen using the kitchen tablet to look up recipes, I imagine, or something like that. And little Junior is sitting by Dad's feet doing her homework, which is pretty cool. Except Mom's white, Dad's black, and the kid's Asian. I haven't told you the good part. Which means that Windows 8 can modify DNA. You know, I shouldn't pick on Microsoft about that because every technology company does that, right? You look at the Apple ads and it's just like, if they could put aliens in there with iPads, they're like, oh, this is... All right, so I downloaded it, and the thing is, remember it said it wasn't going to blow away my stuff. It's going to keep my apps, keep my data. So wizard starts, and the wizard has three radio buttons. It says, blow everything away. That's the first one. Blow everything away, but keep the data. Don't blow anything away. You know, keep my applications, keep my data. Okay? So the default was the first one, by the way. So if you're doing a spouse mode install, you know what a spouse mode install is? Wizard comes up, you say, okay, 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 till it stops asking questions. All right? I want to point out because I'm in a European Union country and there are laws, spouse is a gender neutral term, right? Could be man, could be, I don't want anybody shooting me. Anyway, so if I just went click, that would have been the beginning of a real bad day, you know, at the office. And it starts doing this thing, and I realized I hadn't backed my laptop up. I said, you know what? The guys who read my articles, the people who trust me, they don't back their stuff up either, you know, because we're all tough. I should have their experience. So I did that. This is my main laptop, it's got everything in it, installed it without a backup. I know what you're asking. Do they clank when he walks? Do they clank when he walks? And yes, they do. So, anyway, here's the interesting part. If you learn a few keys, so for example, if I want to, you know, I'm sitting here in my Windows laptop that I'm running my presentation from, and if I didn't have a touch screen, I do. Now I have a really cool laptop. I have the Lenovo X230. The X230, it is a neat laptop because it is under 2 kilos, considerably under 2 kilos in weight. It's got the full touch. Fast i7 processor, room for 16 gigs of RAM, and there's a little slice on it that will let you add a second hard drive, and it's still lighter than most laptops. So if you want a laptop that understands Windows 8, it is a great, great tool, and the price is reasonable too. Now, to get to that start screen, though, If I can't touch, it's a real pain in the neck. So instead, has anybody done that? Has anybody played around with the mouse where you got the mouse down in the corner and you got to find that little start menu thing? Yeah, well, they made it better in 8.1. That, by the way, that's one of the nice things about 8.1. But you know, the first thing, the answer is just press the Windows key. Do you know that Windows key, the key on your keyboard you've never used before? Now it's your best friend. Now it's your best friend. If you want to go back to the desktop, Windows D. There's a command, the Explorer command. Getting to Explorer is a little weird now. It's like if you click on Explorer, it only reopens the existing Explorer. So Windows E pops up in Explorer for me very easily. The charms, which are easy to get to on a touchscreen, but not otherwise. Windows C for charms. If you just want to go, and from there you can go to Windows settings, which is, that's important stuff. It also takes you to the thing called the immersive control panel. To Windows settings, you want to go straight to Windows settings? That's Windows I. It's I because there's an I in settings. And seriously, you can then use the Windows followed by the page up and page down if you've got multiple monitors. And you have seen demonstrations of how you could. Has everybody seen demonstrations of the reason that the Windows tablets are cooler than the iPad tablets? Is that with the iPad, when I want to like make a Delta reservation on Delta Airlines, I need my calendar up and the Delta app, and I'm switching back and forth because the iPad only does one thing at a time. With Windows, I can snap an application on one side and get the other piece, the big chunk on the right side, and then on the left side, I get a bigger piece. If you just do Windows period, it just cycles you through all the possibilities, which is the quickest way to do it. Seriously, I mean, when I, you know, all joking aside, I was the guy having dinner with Stephen Rose a month before saying that they were crazy to release it because only touch devices made sense. Stephen said, Mark, you're wrong. There was an extra word in there. And Stephen is a good friend. So, and he's right. He's right. I use it on my Lenovo, and it's great. I use it on a bunch of other systems. Honestly, it's just a few. Let me put them up on the screen. And you'll see this when you download the PowerPoint, too. Shift-P. So there's a bunch. I mean, everybody knows the Windows X. So all really useful stuff. And here's the proof of the pudding's in the eating. Within 2 hours, because I'm sitting there with my new Windows 8 box, and I'm playing with my Surface, and I'm blogging about it, and I realized that I had forgotten I was running Windows 8. Once you get those keys down, it is every bit as productive as you ever were in Windows 7. Don't believe me. Try it out. Just keep that little thing with you, and in no time at all. Another nice thing, too, of course, is that you've probably seen that to find an application in the start screen, you just type it on the screen. You know, to get to Notepad, just type N-O-T, and Notepad comes up. Do you know what almost no one knows? Has anybody done that? You go to the start screen and you start typing N-O-T till Notepad comes up. You know Windows 7 did it too? That was actually one of my favorite Windows 7 features. Okay. So, I want to talk to you guys about the new applications. See, and I mentioned Mr. Nijhaus, the guy who did the presentation, and we have him right here. And as I said before, if you haven't seen that talk, go see that talk. Because here's the good news and the bad news. Now, first of all, what are they called? Well, originally they were called Metro apps, because it was kind of cool, you know, right? And it incorporated a number of design features. Where did a lot of the design features for Metro come from? Hint, it's in Europe. It's an airport in Europe. What was that? Maybe Switzerland, but the first one I was thinking of, the Charles de Gaulle Airport. When the Charles de Gaulle Airport was being designed in the late 60s as the second airport outside of Paris, there were a number of really interesting graphical notions that kind of appeared and have bubbled up in the world, and you see some of them in these Metro apps. But you can't say Metro. That's the bad word, right? I can say it because I don't have a blue badge. Some people just say apps. Some people draw the line and say application is a generic word. App means runs in the start screen. When the word came out at Microsoft that you couldn't say Metro apps anymore, that for the moment they said a Windows 8 design style application. That's a phrase that trips right off the tongue, right? But I'm hearing an awful lot of people say modern apps. When I'm hearing speakers at Microsoft saying it, it's just an easy word. So modern means, you know, as opposed to desktop-y, right? So Windows Store apps, I think, is still the official name. And some of them are referred to as immersive apps. There's a control panel that you can only get to inside the Metro desktop, inside Start Screen, and that's called the immersive control panel. Okay? So, what's important about them? They are the way that you're going to use tablet stuff. They are the way you're going to use the tablet, the way you're going to, you know, answer the challenge of the iPad and the Android tablets and stuff like that. First thing is they're very sandboxed. Now, we've heard this before. I mean, the whole idea with Java was that Java was supposed to be such, the Java applications would be very sandboxed. That didn't turn out so well. But, you know, years have gone by. We know more about how to build that stuff. And I don't know that anyone's figured out how to build a Metro app, a modern app that can break out of the sandbox. We'll see. We'll see. Now, the good thing about it is that, and this is this. How many times have you heard, I know that I get this email all the time, where some administrator says, you know, Mark, I'm setting up a network, I've read all your books. How do I set things up so that users don't have the right to install applications? They seem to think that there's a button in Windows that says, if you have this button, you can install apps, otherwise you can't. That's not true, of course. By building a new platform, by building the WinRT platform, that's kind of the under-the-hood name for the one for the stuff that the tablet runs on, then it's possible for Microsoft to be able to say, this is safe enough that users can install apps. Having said that, there's a security model that also makes it essentially impossible for people to install apps, and there's a security model that makes it absolutely impossible for anyone to run them. You ever played around with AppLocker? Has anybody ever played around with AppLocker? That was a Windows 7 feature, nice Windows 7 feature. It becomes really interesting if you're running Windows 8, because it has a special section where it lets you control the runnable Metro apps or not. That's good news. What's the bad news? The bad news is, because the sandbox is one that really, really restricts what you can do, it would be hard to write a lot of management applications. It would be hard to write a device manager inside Metro, inside the Start Screen. Now, let's be clear. That might change. I might not understand the way things work properly. But I get the impression that anything that affects the system is very hard to write inside WinRT. That make sense? Now, having said that, though, any application that's run as you, well, you know, nothing protects you from screwing your own stuff up. So when we say that Metro is a sandboxed application, sandboxed means you can't screw up other people's data. And it says you can't screw up the system. But you can screw yourself up. I mean, that's something you always have the ability to do. Okay? So now, within these apps, the deployment story is very different. And why? Here's a central, important concept. Here's the big concept. The big concept is, if I'm Mark, if I'm the administrator, and you are Joe or Jane or Martin or whatever, we're used to the idea that I can use tools like, anybody here use MDT, Microsoft Deployment Toolkit? Really? Next time I ask, I want all of the hands up. It's a great tool, guys, you know? I mean, it makes your life a whole heck of a lot easier trying to roll stuff out. Anyway, if you're doing something like an MDT, if I'm the administrator, I can build a bunch of files using MDT, or I can do it by hand, and I can essentially push a button and roll out Windows with applications to you. As the administrator, I can pre-provide you applications. And you're looking at me funny like, we know that, Mark. I know. Because it's been that way forever. This is a different model, though. It's a more device-oriented model. Applications follow users. Users can associate themselves with up to 5 devices. So if you go to the Windows Store and you buy Angry Birds, you can put Windows 8 or Windows RT on 5 devices. You can have it on as many as you want, but the Windows Store will only refer to 5 devices. So what happens is you get a device either you buy or is rolled out to you from your domain. And if it's a Windows 8 device or an RT device, you've got to attach your name to it. It's not your domain account. It is instead your Microsoft ID, what used to be a Hotmail account or a Live ID. So because of that, this is the weird part. Joe Administrator or Jane Administrator, in general, cannot install an app for you. You with me? That's important. It's not the end of the world, though. Understand that there are 4 ways. I'm simplifying. Again, go back and look at Michael's presentation. He goes into this in greater detail. But there's basically four ways for me as an admin to make it easy for you to get a Windows 8 app. Ready? First one, we can pre-provision them. That's a word. Provision is a phrase that means if I'm building your Windows 8 image, then I can roll it out. And by the way, almost everybody raised your hand when I said, have you used Windows 8? Microsoft pre-provisions applications. Like what? Bing News, Bing Maps, IE. Everybody's seen those, right? That's called provisioning. There's about 15, if I remember correctly, that are built into Windows 8. I don't know what 8.1 is going to do, because I haven't downloaded it yet. I haven't had time. Actually, I haven't downloaded it yet, because all the networks are really slow, because all you guys are downloading it. So I'll wait till I'm back home. My own cable modem, for God's sakes. Anyway, there's room for 24 more of those. So if I'm building an image that I'm going to roll out to the company, I can put applications in there. And I'm going to talk to you about how to do that very briefly. There's another. So that's it. That's the only thing an admin can do. Other than that, an admin can create a start script, you know, your startup script that you run all the time. It runs as you. And your admin can put a command, a PowerShell command in that will install. So you are essentially, you as a user, not an admin, are doing the installation. Your admin's just making your life easier by putting this command, add-apex package, into your startup script. Your admin can alternatively give you these big, giant URLs called deep links. A deep link takes you inside Windows Store, essentially. It's not exactly right. But it takes you essentially inside the Windows Store and says, I want that app. And then the fourth kind is, again, how many of you are deploying Windows 8? I want to find if there's anybody out there that's deploying Windows 8. Anyway, so if you are, then you have a question, which is, how do I get Windows 8 tablet applications? A lot of you said you've played with this, so what's the answer? The answer is, can I just download an application that's a tablet app and stick it in my Windows 8 tablet? No, I can't. It's a similar model to the one that Apple does, where you've got to go through the company store. Well, that's all well and good. But many of your organizations have line of business applications. I assume that none of you only use Office and Adobe Reader. I assume that you've got some kind of line of business stuff that you run. Okay? How do you distribute that? You could put it in the Windows Store, but nobody cares. I mean, it's just your application you built for your company. Why would anybody else want it? You could put it in the Windows Store, but you probably won't. It is possible instead to build your own company store. There's a number of ways of doing this. You could get Intune. You can get System Center, Config Manager. What a lot of folks don't know is that on Codeplex, there's companystore.codeplex.com. And there's a company store you can start right up. And it lets you take your stuff, your applications that you haven't put in the Microsoft Store. So if I run it on just on my computer, there it is, company store. And I haven't customized it at all. But some nice stuff you can do. Does this all make sense? Anybody got a question so far? No? Okay. So, deep links, they are URLs. So again, why so different? Different licensing model. Apps are connected to your user's live ID, not their domain account, and not their machine. And that's why the install is user-centric rather than admin-centric. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the details. Again, I don't have time to do this in great and ugly detail. But let's first of all talk about the way the applications are delivered. The applications are delivered as a file called an appx file. And by the way, if you want to play with this stuff, so if you want to try this thing called sideloading yourself, I've built a little application. It is the world's lamest application. I mean, seriously. Whatever lame application you've seen in the past, this one takes the cake beyond the cake, okay? But I did it for you guys, and it's right there, www.vanessa.com/sampleapp.zip. If you want to follow the examples I'm going to do in this PowerPoint, then unzip it to C:// sample app. C:// sample app, and let's see what that's going to look like. So if I... So if I take a look at sample app, right up top, It's got a folder I'm going to go take a look in. And there's several important files there. All of the modern apps are signed. Not only signed, but they're signed down to the 64K level. All the files that are involved with the modern app are chopped up into 64K chunks. I don't know if they call them tiles or what they do. And they're all hashed. So not only is it signed, they've hashed. So if anybody tries to modify any part of a modern app in any way, they're just going to stop. It's going to say, I'm sick. I can't run anymore. I've got to be reinstalled. So malware is going to be a little difficult for these guys. Anyway, there's a certificate there. That certificate is just because I created a bogus one out of Visual Studio. If you guys are building your own applications, you're going to be using your own certificates. Okay? But in this case, I've got a cert I've got to worry about. The big file, that's the big file. That's the important file, the APX file. And as is the case with the other X things that Microsoft's come up with, you know, like DocX and things like that, it's actually a zip file. And so if I were to take and copy that and paste it, and then just change its extension to zip. You see that it is indeed a folder. XML files and other chunks to make the app work. Okay. So what can I do with an APX file? In order to do a lot of this stuff, you need the APX file itself, the APX file, the APX folders. So assuming that you have one, it's a line of business application that you built, how are you going to roll it out? You could provision it. You could provision it by adding it to an option. Those are the pre-installed things. How do we find out about these guys? Our friend PowerShell. Now, a lot of you said you're not big PowerShell types, so just very, very quick review about PowerShell. PowerShell commands always look like verb-noun. There's a small number of verbs that makes understanding PowerShell and guessing about what the next PowerShell command is going to be a heck of a lot easier. Small number of verbs. So get, if you're thinking show, if you're thinking display, if you're thinking list, that's not right. It's get. Get is the safe one. Get-anything will not break things. So for example, as an Active Directory guy, when I first got a hold of some Active Directory commandlets, the way I could find out what I could see about Active Directory users was I had to get the noun, APX provision package, AD user, system, process, whatever. Now, where did I get that from? Usually you find it in the documentation. You read a blog or something like that. Or you can always just say get-command. Get-command will show you every single command in your PowerShell system. Be advised, it'll be a lot. So once we see that APX provision package is the noun, to show all the ones that are built into my system, all I got to do is say get-APX provision package. And assuming I haven't messed with my system, I can just say get-APX there we go. And notice this tab completion, thank God, because a lot of PowerShell, I've owned cars that aren't as long as some PowerShell commands. So, dash online, that says let me see what's on the machine I'm running. It thinks about it for a second, and it says, okay, these are some things I know. And you see that it's showing me, for every app, showing me a display name, a version, an architecture ID, and a package name. Package name's the important one. Because if I want to get rid of it, or if I want to add one, I've got to know those things. And so, if I were to say, I could then say get-APX package, APX provision, sorry. And online. But I only want to see the package name. So in that case, I could just say select and package name. That gives me a shorter list. The value of that is maybe before I deploy my systems, I don't want Bing Sports on everybody's system. That's going to be, whichever one is the sports, that's going to be the package name that I would then use in combination with remove -apex package to take stuff out. So there's two things we want to do about provisioning. One is we might want to get rid of some of the ones that are already built in. And secondly, we might want to deploy some of the ones, some of our line of business stuff. You can even take it a step further. Some people would say things like, well, I want to be able to roll out, you name it, some application, Angry Birds. Oh, yeah. Anyway, so you would go to the vendor and say, I'll give you this much money if I can roll out 1,000 copies of this. And they give you the APEX file. So this is one way to do it. Okay, we good on that? So provisioning is one way to do it. Questions on that? All right, good. Next, sideloading. Sideloading is where after the user has this in place, once you've rolled out the system, the user then has the ability or needs the ability to install an APEX package. Now, what did we say about APEX packages? What did we say about Metro apps? That regular users can use them. Regular users can install modern apps. So what are we going to do? You're going to figure out the command line. You, the admin, is going to figure out the command line and put it in your user's startup screen. Okay? So we get or build a tablet app. You've already got one. And in order to sideload, there's a few barriers we've got to go through. Okay? The first barrier is, out of the box, Windows will not let you sideload. Sideload means I'm installing something I didn't get from the Windows Store. There's a registry entry that you got to flip that says it's okay to do this. There is a group policy that corresponds to that as well. The apps are all signed. So you have to trust that certificate. Well, now, if you guys are writing your own apps, then I'm pretty sure that you already trust that certificate. But if you want to play around with it, you'll have to install something. Then you got to get a license to sideload. And how is that going to work? Well, let's take a look at these. So we can try it yourself. First, with that sample app that I gave you, there's a certificate that you need to install. And it's got to go into your machine root. Anybody here ever use certutil? It's a powerful command. I've never met the man who wrote it, but he must be crazy, because everything you could possibly want to do is there in certutil. And the documentation is not as good as might be nice. So that's why my friend PowerShell is great. Import-certificate. I wonder what that command does. And then the name of the cert, and then -cert store location, cert:. PowerShell does this thing where it makes things look like drive letters. So within the certificate infrastructure, so I'm going to local machine and root. Then you change the registry entry. And so far, so good. Let's go to my virtual machine. Let me install my fantastic application. By the way, I see the tension. I see the tension in your faces. I am going to run the app. You will see the app running, and you will be astounded. So, if I come over here, I have already installed. I've already made the registry bit flip. I have already installed the application. I now need a license. Where do I get this license from? Three possible places you get the license from. If you use Windows Enterprise, that's almost everybody, right? If you use Windows Enterprise and it's joined to a domain, then you're pretty much done. If you're not joined to a domain, there's a license you get from Microsoft. It's on your licensing page. So if you're domain joined with Enterprise, you're already groovy. Don't worry about the license. If you want to mess around and install a copy of Pro, like I'm doing here, you can get a 30-day developer license from Microsoft. And this is very useful for when you're first trying to figure out how to do this stuff. And the way I do it is I just say show-windows developer license registration. That goes out on the internet and says, you want to renew your developer license? I say, sure, I agree. You betcha. And I just log on in. And by the way, you only have to do this every 30 days. Again, it's just for your test environment. You're not going to do this. I'm renewed. And now where's my APEX package? Well, I'm going to say add-APEX package. And then it's going to want to know where to find that APEX. And so it's just going to be /sample app/. Not that, that. And I'm looking for the APEX file. So there's my command. We're saying add. Add is going to be a PowerShell verb that says add something that where there's more than one of them. That's the path for the big ugly thing. You'll have it in a share or something like that. Then I just tap enter. It thinks about it for a moment. And we look around. And look, there's a new icon there. Tell you how long I worked on that. That's the default one. If you don't do anything else, that's the one you get. So you ready? Is everybody ready? Yes? Okay. That's all it does. That's all it does. But thank you. You're a great audience. So this reminds me also about another thing. When I said give Windows 8 a try, do one more thing for me, okay? Learn the gesture language. So for example, I mean, everybody knows, everybody figures out you click on the tile and you get the whatever, okay? But if you want to see your task manager, there's a gesture for that. You kind of wiggle your finger over on the side. If you want to close an app, a lot of people have said to me, and the reason I know this is that I was at TechEd New Orleans three weeks ago. Thousands of people waited hours online to buy a Surface Pro or a Surface RT. And I'd walk around and people were just like, I can't figure out how to close an application. And I would give them my little 5-minute tutorial on how to do it. And so I would just say, one way to do it is to click this, pull down. But the other thing I like is that there's an old keystroke we've known for ages, and that works too. Alt F4 shuts down Metro apps just like anything else did. So learn the gesture language. And I like the idea of a gesture language, truthfully, because I've been making gestures at my computers for 40 years, and the idea that they would understand the gestures just tickles me. Makes me real happy. Okay? And there's my AppX. And then, so that was the AppX command, add-AppX package. So what have we talked about? I said there were four ways to do it. And again, I apologize for having to use a time on this, but I think it's the most important thing here that I want you all to understand this stuff. So we saw how to provision using a PowerShell command. We've seen about AppX packages. We see how to deploy an AppX package. What was the third way? The third way was to give a deep link, big, ugly, long URL, give a deep link to a particular application to your user and just have your user click on it. The only question then is, how do you build that deep link? It's a little hard to find. There's different ways to do it. I'll tell you the cheater's way that I do it. I'll go to the Windows Store or my company store, and on the page that says, click here to install, I don't click there to install. I bring up the charms. Remember the charms, little five guys over here? Okay. And one of the charms is called the sharing charm. It says, what would you like to share with? If you have OneNote installed, then OneNote can grab it. The mail app, everybody gets the mail app. That'll do it as well. Share it to OneNote. Open OneNote. There'll be a huge, huge hyperlink. Just grab that URL, copy it, and then you can paste it into Notepad or whatever it is that you want to. Okay? So questions on apps. Boy, you guys are quiet. You're like, we didn't care about this, Mark. All right, so let's keep going. Let's keep going. So go back and give that stuff a try. Download my little app and give all that stuff a little try. So beyond Windows Store apps, the apps get all the press, but there's the 7.5 stuff. I assume you know file history. I assume you know Windows to Go. Great stuff. A lot of fun. Along those lines, though, let me point out one thing. Does anyone here use previous versions on Windows 7 or Vista? Really? This is like one of the coolest features that was in Vista. So you heard that somebody liked Vista? That was me. I was that guy, okay? And I stand by my liking, because if you were to tell me 20 things you like about Windows 7, I guarantee you 16 of them came from Vista. Well, one of them was that Vista gave us this thing where if you've deleted a file, you can right-click the folder of the file, and there's a previous versions tab. You don't need a server. You don't need anything else. And it was on by default, and it was freaking awesome. And it's great, too, because many times I have shown this to people, and it's like, middle-aged guys who are fathers of snotty 15-year-olds who think they know more about computers than the fathers do, and they come back a month later and they say, my kid lost something in Vista and he didn't know how to get back, and I knew something he didn't know. It was great. The other thing, too, by the way, That's it. Now, if any of you are parents of teenage children, I will not ask you to raise your hands, but if you are, then another thing you do, it turns out this is really important. I do stuff in the command line, but did you know that's not called the command line anymore? It's called the black screen. Seriously. Like, you know, a friend of mine was helping her daughter because she couldn't get on the network. She had a network crisis, so she whipped up the command prompt. She typed ipconfig, just like you would do, fixed everything. Bam, 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 and the daughter's like, Mom, what did you do? She's like, what? She says, you're working in the black screen. She's like, what? You know, like hackers do in the movies. Are you a hacker, Mom? So you just use the black screen, and the kids will think you're really awesome. So anyway, so it was that. Oh, yeah, so storage-related stuff. Anybody ever heard of a 4K native drive? We're changing drive hardware. Know about this. We're changing drive hardware, so the sectors have been 512 bytes since the dawn of time. Really, on the fourth day, God created 512 byte sectors. And, but for various reasons, it's a long story, I can't tell you now, but we can pack more data onto a drive if we go to 4K sectors. But the problem is, like, everything assumes it. If you go to 4K systems, like, planes don't fly anymore, and, you know, subway stops running. And so, a number of things that we need is we need a BIOS that understands it, the new UEFI BIOSes that they're pushing for Windows 8 understand it, and Windows 8 and Server 2012 are the first versions of Windows that understand 4K. So you guys look at me like, I don't know what it is. Trust me, you're going to love it. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. It means better performance out of the drives that you have. Understand solid-state drives. Does anybody here ever put Windows 7 on a solid-state drive? Okay. What's the first thing you have to do? You have to tell it to don't defrag ever, right? Okay, let's. Okay, you guys are very quiet. Let's talk about this, okay? You know, if you take a solid state drive and you write it a lot, then all of a sudden it does that, okay? You know, this is bad, right? So defragging doesn't make sense on a solid state drive because, wait for it, it's solid state. And nothing moves. So defragging doesn't make any sense. But if you want to destroy your expensive Samsung solid-state drive quickly, run a defrag twice a week, okay? Which, you know, Windows does. So the first thing you got to do is you got to tell Windows, stop defragging. With Windows 8, you don't have to do that. Windows 8's first version of Windows, it goes, oh, solid-state, not defragging. No, we're not doing that. Doing trimming instead. So this is very good. So Windows 8 can actually save you in disk money. You didn't know that, but it's okay. A lot of the storage, does anybody here have that? Anybody here have a home server? With that big disk expander thing? Yeah. Are you all mad at Microsoft because they got rid of home server? Well, the home server stuff is here in Windows 8 now. So essentially, everything you liked about home server is in Windows 8. You can mount ISOs and VHDs. You can double-click on them. Or alternatively, there's a PowerShell command that will do this for you as well. Let's talk about CheckDisk, though, because I promise you, you will fear the CheckDisk no more. So here's the deal. What does CheckDisk do? Well, this is a very long story. I'm giving you the very short version. Ever since... Now, the Microsoft... blog posts say ever since Vista. I don't think that's correct. To my knowledge, Windows has been doing this since Windows 2000. So what happens is, if some application's trying to read a part of the disk, and the operating system says, hey, we had some trouble reading that part of the disk. Maybe we couldn't read it all together. It had some errors. We get some smart feedback, something like that. That disk has a problem. We need to go look at that. And so with every version of Windows, Windows has been getting smarter about, hey, let's stop and fix this on the fly. So Windows can fix a lot of stuff on the fly. And Windows 8 does even more than Windows 7. With me so far? But with Windows 7, or Server 2008 R2 for that matter, if Windows is trying to read or write something, or maybe you're doing a checkdisk slash F. Does everybody know checkdisk slash F? Of course we do. We've lived through it for years. Well, checkdisk will then look at something and say, oh, that's a big problem. You know to fix that? I've got to take this volume offline. What does that mean to take a volume offline? It's like pulling a floppy disk out of a slot. It's like pulling a USB stick out of a socket. It's like pulling a hard drive off its cables. Now, in some cases, that's okay. If your drive F has nothing more than text files on it, Notepad's not going to bark at you. But anything that keeps files open doesn't like having the files dismounted on the fly. And so sometimes, for years, you've seen CheckDisk say, you're saying, I want to work on drive E. It says, no, wait a minute. I've got to dismount it. Is that okay? What do you say when it says, can I dismount that drive? Has anybody said yes? No, you wouldn't have your job. You wouldn't be here. Okay, well, anyway, so, yeah, so in general, you want to be very careful about doing that stuff. And by the way, and I'll give you an example. There's a PowerShell commandlet that did this to me. It took my Drive E offline, and my PowerPoints were there. If you do that, PowerPoint gets so upset that you lose every picture in every page of your PowerPoint. Important safety tip. Don't do that. So what happens if we take Drive C offline while it's running? Well, that's the beginning of a bad day at the office, you know, because it can't get to, like, you know, drivers. That's sort of bad. And so what CheckDisk does now is this. CheckDisk slash F is still around. But there's now a CheckDisk. By the way, you never have to run CheckDisk. It runs at least once a day in the background. And it just touches everything. And if it can fix something on the fly, it fixes it on the fly. If it can't, it's got two new files, $verifying and $corrupt. And if it finds bad areas, it writes those notes. You with me so far? So there is this file, and I'll show you how to look at it because I know all you want to look at it now. Right? Now, what happened in the past? In the past, if CheckDisk had a problem, it would mark a disk as being dirty because it had to do some offline maintenance on it. And you'd boot the system up, and it would run CheckDisk slash F, and that's why you fear CheckDisk, because if you've got a 2 terabyte drive on your server, that's going to be a long operation. And explaining to the boss that the Exchange server is going to be offline for just 6 hours is usually the beginning of a really bad day at the office. Because the problem is this. Basically, like, CheckDisk just leaves a note to itself. Something screwed up. CheckDisk goes to sleep. You reboot the system. It wakes up. And CheckDisk sees a note by the bed that says, something's wrong with Drive E. It's like, well, what's wrong with Drive E? I don't know. Just got to check it. What Windows 8 and 2012 do that makes a lot of sense is it leaves a note by the bed. It doesn't say, go fix E. It says, E has a problem at this sector, Do it. So the beauty of this now is instead of doing CheckDisk slash F, CheckDisk slash scan runs in the background. And then first thing in the morning, it boots up to CheckDisk slash spot fix. CheckDisk slash spot fix says, take it offline. And once you've taken it offline, look at the very specific areas that are in $verify and $corrupt. Does that make sense? Makes a huge amount of sense. And one more nice feature. CheckDisk slash F is still around. It's got a feature slash SD cleanup. What's that all about? Have you ever looked at a folder on a server or a workstation and looked at the permissions? And there's a little icon of the head, and there's the name of the group or something. But sometimes there's a head with a question mark in it, an empty head with a question mark in it. And there's just a SID next to it. Ever seen that? What's that all about? Well, someone added a permission that referred to a user account and then deleted the user account. So NTFS is saying, all right, there's somebody I can't find who has an opinion. Hell, what am I going to do? You know? What SD cleanup does is it goes out and it says, okay, do you still exist? Do you still exist? Do you still exist? And it verifies all this stuff. So you do SD cleanup and it will find all of the ACEs, all the access control entries that point to systems that don't exist, to people or groups that don't exist anymore. Sound cool? Yes? Okay, one thing. Make sure you're connected to the domain controller while you do this. Otherwise, it's going to be the beginning of a very bad day at the office. All right? PowerShell has something like that as well. There's a PowerShell repair dash volume. I want you to be very, very, very careful, though, because I discovered this the hard way, that CheckDisk asks you if it can take something offline. PowerShell doesn't. I don't know why. Because PowerShell's usually doing the dash confirm with me all the time. No, it took my eDrive offline, and I told you what happened. So this is good stuff. It's the same basic code under the hood, but if you have all the extra PowerShell goodness, whatever. To know what CheckDisk knows, there's a command called fsutil, and it will let you look at $corrupt and $verify. So if you want to look at one of your servers that you never reboot, like, for example, how many are running server core? Really, only a few of you? Okay. I find that server core systems don't get rebooted nearly as often as regular GUI servers do. So if you're doing it in 2012, do that fsutil and find out what's going on with the $corrupt and $verify. So, okay. Okay. Anybody here ever had to put Windows into... How am I doing for time? Good. Anybody ever had to put Windows into safe boot mode? Right? F8? Okay. What did I tell you before we got started? Don't use F8. It doesn't work anymore. Because honestly, it didn't make any sense anymore. Systems are so fast that me having to stab F8 before the thing boots. You know, when my computer was a 33 megahertz 386, that was okay. I now have a 3,000 megahertz i7. That's like, you know, when it's not a repair tool, when it's a video game, then that's not good at all, right? No, seriously. In 1980, I was the Washington, D.C. area champion at Tempest. Anybody remember Tempest? No? Anyway, well, trust me, I was good. And I can't do this. So F8 doesn't work anymore. There are a lot of blog posts that people have put in that say Shift F8 works. That may have worked during the beta. It certainly does not work in the current, in the shipped version. So, thing to understand is that Microsoft is thinking in terms, when you think about Windows 8, in some ways, think tablet. So, like, if your iPad goes wonky, what do? You hold down a couple of buttons, and it gets stupid for a minute, and then it essentially restarts itself. And you've lost your data, and you've lost your apps, and you've got to reinstall them. Right? It's a reset kind of. It's a phone model, essentially. It's a phone model. We're seeing something like that. We'll talk about refresh and reset very soon. But we're seeing a model kind of like that. And so the notion here is that if you, I'll give you another example. When I got my Surface, loved my Surface. But how many of you have a Surface? Anybody got a Surface? Let me see. Okay. For those who don't know, the Surface has a Windows button on it, but it's not a real button. It's just like a little plaque. It's a little flat thing. And when you press it, it makes a little buzzy feel. Kind of like, ooh, ooh, you know, when you click it. And it's nice. You should try it. And so something went wrong with my Surface. It didn't sleep right or something like this. I'd had it about 5 weeks. And I turned it on, and it just says, Surface. That's the way it starts up. Surface. And that's all it said. So I tried to, you know, I'd reset and everything. So, Surface. I'm like, I'm not underwater. Why does it keep telling me to Surface? You know? So anyway. But if you push the little button, it would kind of buzz at you, which is really annoying. It's like, I hear you, but I'm not going to do anything with it. You know, So I looked it up, and the answer was, well, you should boot off your recovery USB stick. Huh? What? Huh? Well, as it turns out, the first thing you're supposed to do when you get certainly a Surface, but I'm going to tell you for Windows 8 devices in general, is build a recovery USB. It's super simple. Just get a USB stick, go to Control Panel, search on recovery, and it will take the USB stick, it'll wipe it clean, so make sure there's nothing there you care about, it'll make it bootable, and it has all the stuff that you need to start recovering your Windows 8 device. You do not need one for every Windows 8 device. Every one you have is pretty much good, I think, for all of mine. I think the driver situation is pretty much straightforward. Okay? Did anybody here have an RT? Or did anyone buy an RT for, what was it, 80 euros, something like that? Okay. That's like $5,000 or something like that. Yeah, make that recovery USB stick. By the way, an interesting story was that the Microsoft guys took my Surface and gave me a new one with no questions asked. I thought that was cool. I think you've probably heard this a lot. I apologize. It was in my deck already. But this is, I don't know if I said this before the talk or as I was starting, but this may be, in some senses, if you're a security person, this may be the single coolest thing in Windows 8. This is essentially, as I said, Microsoft eradicating smallpox. If you're worried about rootkits, you should be. If you're worried about bootkits where they actually flash the malware into your ROM, yikes. That pretty much, you know, at that point it's game over with your computer, right? About all you could do is you can put like eyes on them and run chains through them and you can use them to stop boats. That's pretty much about all you can do with systems that have got a bootkit. So this pretty much essentially kills us. And the way that it does it is that there's a certificate in your BIOS, so to speak, and that chains to all the code that's in your BIOS. So you know how Windows has had signed code in the kernel since, I guess, Windows 2000. Now it's in your BIOS as well. So it's really hard for malware to do mean things at this point. So that's the first thing. Second thing is early launch anti-malware. This, I don't think, has been well explained in a lot of cases. So here's briefly what it works. The idea, again, is that while Windows is booting, if I can get to it before it gets too far in the booting process, I can do a lot more kinds of scans. And so Microsoft added this extra little slot early on so that when it boots up, it can run anti-malware software at that point. So better time for scanning to happen. It happens with Microsoft's Defender, but it'll work with third-party tools as well. Okay? Make it sense? Good stuff. One thing I should mention to you, though. Elam is on your systems by default, but listen closely. Here's what it does. So imagine you're Elam. You're scanning a driver, an important driver, and you realize it's infected. What are you going to do? You can't say to the user, oh, you can't talk to your disk because the driver's infected. That's not going to be popular. So the default behavior is, I will note that it's infected, but I won't do anything. I'll let it run. Okay? And you want that, because if you didn't know about Elam and your Windows 8 boxes stopped dying, there'd be a lot of press, you know? So think about it. Once you feel you have a good anti-malware place, story in place, you may want to think about changing that group policy to say that if there's a bad important boot driver, stop the system cold. Other things. Not everybody knows this, but Defender, which used to do just spyware, now does malware as well. Even better, has anyone looked at offline Defender? Really, almost nobody? That makes me sad. For years, I've been begging Microsoft to give us a version of Defender that you can stick on a USB stick, and that's what they've done. It's a version of Defender that goes on a USB stick. You can download it free. Anyone can. Same deal. It's going to make a bootable USB stick for you. What's the beauty of this? The beauty of this is that you're booting the system cold off this USB stick, which means you could have 15 kinds of rootkits and it wouldn't matter because the rootkits only work once the operating system is running. Make sense? All right, good. Check that stuff out. It's really important. All right, PowerShell. I have just a few things to say about PowerShell. So we talked about the basic structure, verb dash noun. There's a lot of good help built into it. Tons and tons of blogs and some really good resources. I can't stress to you strongly enough that with every year it goes on, there's fewer and fewer of us support people and more of those users out there, more and more of those servers out there, more and more of those desktops out there. You need automation. I was at the MVP summit this last, when the heck was it? I don't remember, March, May, something like that. And this friend of mine, he's a Brazilian guy who works he's another directory services guy. And he says, Mark, you always talk about PowerShell. It drives me crazy. Stop talking about PowerShell. I don't want to learn PowerShell. I said, why? He said, it's hard. I said, it's easy. Noun dash verb. Learn dash PowerShell. Very simple, okay? He says, I don't want to learn PowerShell. I said, leave dash industry, okay? So, seriously, when you, if you're an Exchange administrator, you know what happened there. If you're a System Center Virtual Machine Manager administrator, you know what happened there. When a Microsoft group gets the PowerShell bug, they not only put great PowerShell support in there, but they go so crazy that there's some things you can only do with PowerShell, right? Any Exchange administrators in the room, right? There's some stuff you can only do with it. And as an Active Directory guy, there's some stuff I can only do with PowerShell. So you got another stuff. There's a great new command too called show-command. It's been around since Windows 7 that will make any PowerShell item into a commandlet. So some nice stuff. Give you some examples, some nice disk commandlets. How many of you fix disks? How many of you ever use the disk part command? Now, is that a fun thing to run? I say, is that a fun thing to run? Oh, get out. You type disk part and it goes. And you're like, I just need to find the disk number. You know? Like, I'm going to create a bootable floppy. I said, bootable floppy, good Lord. A bootable USB stick. I pop it in, and to go to disk part, I got to know, is it disk number 0, disk number 1, disk number 2? So then I type disk part, and disk part says, dude, I was on a break. Can I get back to you soon? PowerShell's got commands for that now. Right now, you can say get dash disk. You don't have to wait around for disk part. Oh, by the way, PowerShell works on Windows PE2. You can stick it on a bootable USB stick. Awesome. Clear dash disk and initialize dash disk. Read the help on those before you use those, okay? Is anybody here deploying BitLocker?
Yes.
I said, is anybody out there deploying BitLocker? How come you're not deploying BitLocker? How many machines get lost or stolen in Europe every year? I don't know. In the United States, it's 1 million laptops get lost every year by organizations with important data on it. And it's free. Comes in the box. It's good. Please. That's another story. Okay, but just please, do BitLocker. Anyway, BitLocker gets easier with a bunch of some really, really nice PowerShell commandlets. If you've done BitLocker, you have to mess with a TPM chip. Has anybody ever had to deal with their TPM? Well, it becomes much easier. You don't have to go to that MMC anymore. We've got get-tpm, initialize TPM. Here's another one I have to do. Sometimes if I plug in one of my hard drives and I want it to be drive E because Lightroom wants it to be drive E. Something else has taken drive E. You ever seen a problem like that where you want a particular drive, particular letter? Yeah. That means I get to mess around in disk part or something like that. Instead, now you got a PowerShell command. Set dash partition dash drive letter X dash new drive letter Y. That easy. That easy. It's over 1,000 new commandlets in Windows 8. Start playing with them. Start playing with them. Some good stuff. I'm sorry, that's not right. It's 1,000 new commandlets coming up from Windows 7. And then Windows 8 gets some more as well. All right, what's that you say? You're still not impressed? How about this one? Ever had to set up a VPN for one of your users? That's fun, huh? Click, 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 wait, click. Add dash VPN connection dash name to office dash server 4.3.2.1. How about those IP config commands? Ever had to re-register dynamic DNS? Register dash DNS client. If you needed, for example, to change your IP address, you now have a nice command, much easier to work with than Netch. Way easier than Netch. Has anybody ever tried to schedule a task from the command line? It's a nice tool, but it's not a great tool. The PowerShell tools are 1,000 times easier. Do you keep track of file servers? Get-smb open file. You're about to shut something down. You're not sure if there's an open file. There it is. You don't have to go looking in Resource Monitor. Anybody here ever have to deploy printers? Oh, come on. I've heard this a lot. Much of the email that I get over the years is, I need something that makes it easier to deploy printers. I want a user to be able to have a particular printer when he or she's at a particular location. I want them to roll out certain printers automatically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's all good. That's all great. And there's some group policies for it, too. But still, I hear it's difficult. Well, how about this one? Add-printer driver, you've got to be an admin to do. So as an admin, you're going to roll out printer drivers with a system, use an MDT or something. But then when you want to add a printer, well, users can do that. Add-printer, any user can run. Add-printer-connection name, whack, whack, server one, big printer. That's going to go out and create a connection to a shared printer. The get-printer command, in combination with remove-print job, ever needed to clean out a bunch of junk print jobs? Instead of clicking on the print job, right-clicking, doing cancel and waiting for the hourglass, just do that. As I mentioned, bootable USB sticks are easier. Used to be that in order to build a bootable USB stick, we used the Windows Automated Installation Kit, or the WAKE. It got a new name and a bunch more stuff. It's called the Assessment and Deployment Toolkit, or the ADK. You can still build Windows PE images. That's fairly simple. You can find 1,000 blogs in the world on it. Look at Newsletter 59 on my site to find out about doing it. But you used to have to build a bunch of separate commands. Now this one command here, make WinPE Media, creates a bootable USB stick for you very quickly. Refresh reset, I find a lot of people don't understand. The basic idea here is, again, think about a phone. Think about a phone. Reset says wipe all your stuff. Have your system in a state where you can give it to your kid or give it to a random person on the street and you don't have to worry about it. Refresh says let's roll back settings and stuff like that. Don't really blow the operating system up, but see what we can actually do. And you access it from the immersive control panel. So refresh restores your trusted things. Refresh kind of takes you back to an out-of-the-box image almost, but your Metro apps are still there. And a class, not all of them, but a class of some of the desktop apps are fine. When you see the refresh, they say it's instantaneous. My experience has been a refresh can be up to 15-20 minutes, depending on the speed of the hardware and such. What's reset do? Now, reset's going to do something else for you. It's going to get your system to the point where you can just give that machine away. It'll wipe your hard drives, wipe all your data, remove the applications. It does the wipe in the usual way. It will do a certain number of writes, as many writes as you tell it to do. And at that point, you can give it to somebody. And by the way, how many of you have to worry about once you're done with them, you got to wipe the hard drives before you can give them away? That's a problem, right? What do you do with that? I was at an Army base once, and they said, we grind them. I said, you do what? They said, they have like a shredder. I said, you want to see? I said, yeah, I still want to see. And they dropped this drive in there. It went, and like little shiny powder just came down. If you breathe that, you would die in 3 minutes. All right, I got two more quickies. One, roaming profiles and folder redirection. Who uses roaming profiles, folder redirection? Nice feature. Annoying part of the feature is I'm a support person. When I go to somebody's desktop and I log on as me, my crap gets left behind. That's bad. With Windows 8, you can designate a machine. With Windows 8, you can say, I got a roaming profile, I got folder redirection, doesn't go to everything, it only goes to my primary PC. You designate the primary PC in Active Directory, and by the way, it's not like Highlander, there can be more than one. So even though you can have more than one primary PC, you do something like that to get a particular computer account, you designate that computer as being someone's primary computer, and at that point, you can look that up a little later, those are the group policy settings, and our effect is going to be that now, when you sit down at your Windows 8 boxes, folder redirection, roaming profiles only goes to the designated machines. Sound good? Bad news. Windows 7 is still dumb. So if you log on to Windows 7, it's still gonna roam it to everywhere in Windows 7. So that's the way Microsoft says, do an upgrade. All right, my last item. We have just a few seconds left. Oh, no, I'm a few seconds over, forgive me. Okay, last item real quick. PowerConfig has been a great tool for years and years and years. And every time I get a new version of Windows, one of the first things I do, I look at PowerConfig. And PowerConfig, I can run PowerConfig/battery report. And look what it did on my system. And I like you guys so much that I'm going to let you see my actual battery config report. And it's not all good news, friends. So what this thing does is, first of all, it thinks about it for a minute. It creates a battery report -HTML. And first of all, notice the attractive HTML. Look at that. We got colors. It's got that whole Metro kind of look to it, you know? And it shows me like this. I bought this thing in March, and it shows me the state that my battery is in. And then the bad news comes in the end, where it says battery life estimates. So when I bought this thing, is that right? No, sorry. I got to go up one here. There we go. Battery capacity history. So when I bought this thing, like in March, that was the full charge capacity. But now, we're down to that. So it may be that Lenovo wants to put it in there, so I will buy a new battery every 6 months or something along those lines. So, oops, didn't want that. So, my plan here was to show you a couple things that you didn't know about Windows 8. Have I convinced anybody to look at the PowerShell command that's in Windows 8? Anybody? Have I convinced anybody to give Windows 8 a chance, even without touch? Anybody? Have convinced anybody to give it a try? How about some of the other goodies? I thank you for being here. Let me put the QR up real quick, and I want to say one more thing. I got another talk tomorrow. I'm talking about Windows 2012 networking stuff. I hope you will join me. And other than that, thank you. Do an eval. Remember to use this knowledge for good and not for evil. Thank you. Bye-bye.